You're listening to the Tupten Children Podcast.
Well, we'll start with our motivation. So Lama Tsongkhapa, in his three principal aspects of the path, gives us such a vivid picture of our experience in cyclic existence that Khyentser Jompa Tigchuk echoed a bit in this teaching, where he says, swept by the current of the four powerful rivers, tied by the strong bonds of karma that are so hard to undo, caught in the iron net of self-grasping egoism, completely enveloped by the darkness of ignorance, born and reborn in boundless cyclic existence, unceasingly tormented by the three sufferings, and that by thinking of all mother sentient beings in this condition, to generate the supreme altruistic intention. And so these four rivers of ignorance, our sensual desire, our craving for rebirth, our wrong views, it's all part of that network, our karma that we're tied up and bound by. The darkness of ignorance that, as his example, Khyentser Jompa Tigchuk says, bad enough you get thrown into a river tied up like that in the daytime. But then it's dark too. I mean, if we think about it, if we imagine it, it would be terrifying. There's absolutely no way to escape from that. And we think that this is our situation, and it's also the situation of every single being around us. Except that there is a way out, and it's through overcoming this ignorance, this darkness of ignorance that unties everything. Cuts the net, springs the ropes, opens our eyes, brings the light. And so if we think about mother sentient beings, think about all the kindness we've received just today. Think about all the beings that we've come in contact with today being in that same kind of situation. We can set our hearts on really listening to what Nagarjuna, Master Nagarjuna, has been trying to teach us about how to achieve this higher status, higher rebirth, a series of upper rebirths so that we can cultivate this wisdom that overcomes all this. Attain the definite goodness of liberation and full awakening, and bring all beings to that state too. So with a heart of tender concern, let's do our review here tonight. And determine ourselves to be free, and to free all others as well. So we are reviewing Precious Garland. Master Nagarjuna's really amazing text. And what are the main themes? What is Nagarjuna trying to teach us here? Higher rebirth. And high is good. Why? We become fully awakened Buddhas. I turned a little bit to Jeffrey Hopkins. It's quite a beautiful introduction to his translation of this text. And so I have some quotes from him, but one of the things he says is that high status serves as a foundation for definite goodness, in the sense that through gaining a favorable lifetime endowed with the prerequisites for continued practice, wisdom becomes possible. And then wisdom is the very thing that frees us from that whole iron net of self-grasping egoism, the forces of those four rivers, the darkness of ignorance. And ignorance is what keeps us trapped. And it's that same ignorance that prevents us from seeing how bad it is to be in samsara. So in this text. We covered a lot last week, and we'll redo a little bit of what we covered last week because the way Venerable's questions are worded, they kind of interweave between the various verses. So we'll look again at what this higher status, especially this week, is all about and how that leads to that definite goodness of liberation and full awakening. So this, last week we covered faith and wisdom. And so this week we're doing verses 4 through 10 for sure, and maybe we'll get further along than that, up to verse 4, 13. Do people have their text with them? Yeah? I thought it would be nice to actually just read those verses out loud together. So we start with verse 4. Here we maintain that upper rebirth is happiness, and highest good is liberation. In brief, the method for attaining them is summarized as faith and wisdom. Because one has faith, one partakes of the Dharma. Because one has wisdom, one truly understands. Of these two, wisdom is the foremost, but faith must come first. One who does not neglect the Dharma through desire, anger, fear, or confusion should be known as one with faith, a supreme vessel of the highest good. A wise person is one who, having accurately analyzed all actions of the body, speech, and mind, always acts for the benefit of self and others. Refraining from killing and from stealing, not engaging in adultery, restraining from lying, divisive speech, harsh words, and idle talk, abandoning covetousness, malice, and nihilistic views. These are the 10 bright paths of action. The 10 gloomy ones are the opposite. In brief, Dharma consists of not taking intoxicants, maintaining a proper livelihood, abandoning harm, honoring the worthy, and cultivating love. Part of the reason for reading these is that the answers of the questions are all in the verses. Did anybody else notice that? Yeah, it's there. It's all right there. So we have lots of, and we will go into a little bit, we have lots of commentary on that, but the verses themselves contain the content of the questions of the quiz. And really, the verses here are... There are a few points that wouldn't be so clear without the commentary, but once we've had the commentary, then the verses are really quite evident what they're trying to teach. And, you know, our point, the point really of doing the quizzes is not so much to get the right answers, but how to practice and really apply these. So I think meditating on these verses alone, which Venerable certainly advises us to do, the content's right there, it's not hard to do. So I want to go back and start with question number 8, which is where we left off last time. How do we generate faith in karma and its effects? So we answered it partly, and I think Jack piped up with part of the answer too that we talked about a little bit, but I want to go back and be more explicit about how we generate that faith. Because there are really two ways that we generate faith in conviction and karma. And the first way that's given is not the first way that comes to my mind, but it's this formula for how you test the scripture. Right? So first, you ask the question, does the scripture present obvious phenomena, like the things that we can know with our senses by direct perception? Does it present that accurately? Secondly, is the presentation of slightly obscure phenomena, like subtle impermanence, for example, or emptiness, which we can know through inference, through reasoning and inference, does it present that correctly? And then the third one is that in its presentation of explicit and implied meanings, are there contradictions? Or are there contradictions where it says in one place, in one place in the sutra, it might say one thing and then later something else. Are there contradictions in that way? And if we don't find those, so we analyze the text. If we don't find those, then we can rely on that as an authentic authority, right? Or authoritative scripture. The second way, which is the way that makes more sense to me, because I don't have that kind of an analytical mind, and we don't necessarily have access to those scriptures so directly anyway, is to rely on what we already know about have already authenticated for ourselves about the Buddha as a reliable source. Right? So the Buddha taught karma. When we think about the other ways of the Buddha's, other things that the Buddha has taught that we have relied on that do make sense to us, like, for example, our situation in cyclic existence. We think about that, we think, well, yeah, that was pretty accurate, his description of that. When we've examined other teachings that are easier to experience, easier to understand, then our confidence in the Buddhist teaching on karma grows. Right? So does that make sense, people? You know, he talks about the afflictions, things like that, how difficult they are, and also even we apply the antidotes that the Buddha taught. We say, oh, well, this actually makes, it works. Then our confidence in the Buddha grows. So our confidence in understanding karma grows, right? So in general, do people feel like they have conviction in karma, in the law of karma?
I understand it, but my behavior doesn't portray it.
Yeah, you know, Venerable at some other teaching at one time, she said, we all say we believe in karma, but how much do we act like we believe in karma? Yeah.
My belief in it is, and my faith in it is based on my limited belief in it, in limited understanding of it. Like, I understand that virtuous activities bring good, you know, happiness, and non-virtuous activities bring suffering. So there's, I can understand it on that level where I know that the very detailed workings of it are extremely obscure.
Yeah. So understanding kind of in the general way that virtuous action brings virtuous or positive results. Not virtuous, but positive, happy results, pleasurable results. And the opposite is also true, but the details and the intricacies, we don't know. We can't know.
Right. So I don't always have as much faith in that. It's like when they describe the details of what things bring.
So, you mean like later in the chapter where they say from short life comes, or short life comes from killing, or however that goes? Like
you,
that?
If you steal, then you later be stolen from, kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
My experience is if you steal, the result is that people don't trust you anymore.
Yeah, that's the immediate result.
Yeah.
The immediate result of you steal is that people don't trust you anymore.
So that's what
is
I
the see. Result of karma, the long-term result, that you will be stolen from, for example, is one of the results. That's harder to grasp. Is that what you're saying? Or harder to...
It is. And so I'm using both these. Some yeah. that I can understand, yeah. and some that I just have to take Buddha's word.
Yeah. I think that's a good point, Venerable Sangha, because when I think about our faith in karma, I mean, the more I looked at this particular section, it's like, wow, this thing about faith is absolutely fundamental. This thing about faith in karma is fundamental, because he's laying out here over and over in deep ways how it is that we achieve a good rebirth that will put us on the path towards this highest good. How do we do that? We refrain from destructive actions and we engage in specific virtuous actions. But if we're just going through our day, la 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 la, yeah, I believe in karma, and it, you know, restraining from negative actions, some of them, is not so easy. So you know, something about really deepening our faith and our understanding, and I think it has to do also with our faith and understanding in the long-term view, that the appearances of this life being very vivid, it's easy to see, yeah, I steal here today and people around me don't trust me. That's this life. I will not have resources to practice in the future. What future? You know? Kind of like that. So, yeah.
It's on our mind is saying, you need wisdom to support initial faith in karma.
Because?
Because, could you keep typing? I'll let you know.
Okay. Yeah, well, that was my comment. That was my object last week. But Nagarjuna is saying faith comes first.
What kind of faith?
Reasoned faith. But comes before this kind of wisdom. Let me tell you what Jeffrey has an interesting take that maybe is following what this person says. Page 37 on the bottom. I thought it was good, interesting because... he is quoting Aryadeva, Jeffrey does. So Jeffrey says, Nagarjuna singles out faith as the quintessential means for achieving high status, precious, a good rebirth. The quintessential means. But Aryadeva in 400 stanza shows how faith can depend on wisdom. So Aryadeva's verse says, whoever has generated doubt toward what is not obvious in Buddha's word will believe that only Buddha is omniscient based on his profound teaching of emptiness. So Aryadeva's point is that the Buddha is correct with respect to such a profound topic as emptiness, then he must be correct with something less profound but more hidden, such as the minute details of karma and the cause and effect. So if we begin to doubt that, what Aryadeva is saying is that we return to the Buddha's teachings on emptiness, see that these are true. Consequently, through confirming Buddha's teachings of emptiness, a person with doubt about Buddha's teachings concerning achieving specific effects, that person can be reassured and gain belief. Right? So it's true that those two things work with each other. But here he's emphasizing. Yeah?
So the author has responded.
Saying?
Because faith without wisdom is blind faith.
And I think it depends on what you mean by wisdom. Faith without reasoning is for sure. If we are using wisdom to refer to an understanding or penetrating ignorance, we can have faith before we have that wisdom, right? Am I right, or no? I mean,
wisdom,
is that true?
Wisdom
realizing emptiness.
Emptiness is not the only wisdom.
No, the wisdom of hearing, the wisdom of reflecting, those kinds of wisdoms help us generate faith. It's true. So, are we saying that wisdom comes before faith?
We need wisdom to create faith.
Yeah. Due to having faith, oops, one realizes on the practice, what relies on the practices. Due to having wisdom, one truly knows. Of these two, wisdom is the chief. Faith is the prerequisite. That's what Nagarjuna says. And here the commentary says it's the wisdom realizing emptiness. That's the principal cause for liberation. That's the wisdom we're talking about. But before we can generate that wisdom, we have to have this series of upper rebirths. We need to create good karma to do that. In order to do that, we need to develop faith in karma and its effects. And so that's what leads us forwards. So there's also a phrase that Venerable said, when different sentient beings have sharp faculties, they become suitable for realizing emptiness. They will hear the teachings on emptiness, they'll be able to practice them and have the wisdom that realizes emptiness and then attain liberation of full awakening. So that takes us to question number 9. What does it mean for someone to have sharp faculties or modest faculties? And is the path different? Yeah. Reasoned faith.
And that, when we talk about reasoning, we're talking about knowledge and wisdom. We're not talking about the wisdom that realizes emptiness necessarily.
No. I totally support that too. And you're right. There's no right or wrong here. However, the text is talking about a particular kind of emptiness, wisdom.
Right.
The wisdom that realizes emptiness. Yeah.
It's another person on mine has just written, I think the catch here is that by faith we mean confidence. I think that implies that we've used reasoning to determine why the Buddha is worthy of confidence and it's not just blind acceptance.
Yeah, maybe faith is a problematic word. For me, faith is translated in my head as conviction. And that has a whole other implication than just, oh yeah, Buddha said it. In fact, we just talked about how we test it. It's not because the Buddha said it that we have, quote, faith. It's because we tested the Buddha's teachings on all the other things with reasoning, with our wisdom, and then come to accept this one that's more obscure too, I think. Yeah?
Yeah, I think that's what we end up doing.
Yeah.
And then when you have some conviction, then you put some effort.
Right. And the more conviction we have, and that's really my question, how much faith do we actually have, comes from. Because when we have conviction, we will put effort. And I am not even questioning that we do put effort. I'm just looking at my own mind and going, and there's a place where, okay, I believe in karma for the big actions. Do I have faith in karma when it comes to the smaller ones? You know, that thing we talked about last week that is also a part of this in understanding the basic qualities of karma, about karma is expanding. You know, a small action leads to a big result, for example. You know, holding that kind of understanding in mind also helps deepen applying karma to how we practice and how we live. Yeah.
And I think that's the wisdom of learning.
Yeah.
And then we take it and, you know, apply it. Like, that might be the case. Maybe I should think about this before I do something.
Right. And it starts with the wisdom of hearing. So we have to have the wisdom of hearing and learning or thinking too. You're right. Yeah. And if we can go on to question 9, what does it mean for someone to have sharp faculties? A very sharp faculty student might be able to just go for it. So what does it mean for someone to have sharp faculties?
Stumble first, realizes emptiness, and then Buddha
It's a person who first realizes emptiness and then bodhicitta. As opposed to?
Modest.
Yes, modest was a polite word. They usually say dull. So a bodhisattva who would do that.
Yeah,
on the bodhisattva path. Yeah, that's basically that. I actually have a long explanation about it, but maybe that's not necessary. It's interesting that one of the things that Geshe Tashi Sering talks about in his book on developing bodhicitta is he takes exception to these terms. He says, actually, I think someone who is more reasoned would be a person who would need to be convinced that full awakening was possible before they committed themselves to the whole path. And someone who is more inclined to the feeling side of things, whose compassion was so great that they would develop bodhicitta first. So that's his argument a little bit to softening these terms. And I don't think there's anything, what's the word? I don't think it's meant to denigrate people who develop bodhicitta, right, first. But it is, so it's based on someone who gains a conceptual or inferential realization of emptiness. And that by generating that non-dual wisdom, they gain confidence that full awakening is possible. They cultivate bodhicitta and enter the path of accumulation, head on that way. A person of more modest faculties will develop bodhicitta first, and then once they are on the path of accumulation, they'll continue to meditate on emptiness and then develop their inferential realization. So it's like the cause of one bodhisattva is this realization, this inferential realization of emptiness, and the cause of another kind of bodhisattva is their bodhicitta. Okay, question 10. Who is a superior vessel for the highest good?
Someone who does not neglect Gohan's religious practices.
Yes.
One who has faith.
Yep, it says all of that in the verse. It's right there. One who does not neglect the Dharma through desire, anger, fear, or confusion should be known as one with faith, a supreme vessel of the highest good. So again, we're looking at karma. One who does not neglect the Dharma is someone who does not transgress virtuous practices by being compelled by desire, anger, fear, or confusion. These four afflictions. So in her teaching, Venerable had us make some examples about how we might do that, which I thought would be useful to apply. So take the non-virtue of stealing, for example, since it already came up. How would stealing motivated by partiality, like how would, is that possible? Partiality attachment? What does that look like? What's an example of that?
I know people that steal. They won't steal from their friends, or they'll steal from corporations.
That's partiality. They'll steal from corporations, but not from their friends. Yeah.
Hopefully.
What about stealing out of anger? What's an example?
People who are quite poor.
Uh-huh. So it's, yeah, so people who are really poor, like cars, are jealous of people with nice cars, and so out of anger, that jealousy, take the car. Yeah, that's a good example.
The people I was referring to are angry at corporations.
Uh-huh. Anger at corporations. Yeah.
Taking something from work because you feel like you've been slighted.
Yeah, taking something from work because you feel like you've been slighted. I was thinking of walking out on a restaurant bill because your waiter was not so good. I've done it. And what about stealing out of fear? Like food or something like that? Fearful?
Medicine
that you need, something you need, you're afraid you won't be able to get it, and so you'd steal out of it. Yeah, animal jumper.
Yeah. Yes. In school, bullies force kids to steal.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, bullies forcing kids to steal. Just as a power domination thing?
Yeah. You take that from the store and give it to me, otherwise I'll beat you up.
Wow. Oh, to get the thing. And then out of ignorance, stealing out of ignorance.
That's mine is yours, but yours is mine.
Thinking there'll be no result.
Thinking there'll be no result.
There'll be no karmic result of it, of ignorance.
Yeah. Or assuming that what's mine is yours and what's yours is mine. Or that
assuming
cultural.
I'll never get caught.
Yeah, or assuming I'll never get caught. Yeah, very good.
Or you don't even realize it's stealing.
Yeah.
Yeah. All that half and half is sitting out there on Starbucks counter. Who cares if I take it, right? I take that whole thing.
In gangs, part of the initiation is to steal, or else you get beaten up by the other gang members.
Oh, yeah. Sounds so similar to the bullying. So you steal or you get beaten up. So it's like a proving your manhood or something, I don't know. Proving you're something could. Yeah. So, I mean, stealing, I mean, these are kind of heavy ones, but you can see how easily our minds get overwhelmed by these four. Desire, anger, fear, confusion. And so one who doesn't do that, who doesn't go beyond virtue, beyond that kind of virtue, is a good vessel for highest good. Why? Because then you're already starting to create the causes for future, for good rebirths. You're keeping ethical, good ethical conduct, and then you create the merit to receive teachings on that will lead to this definite goodness, too. We create the merit to create the capacity to be able to understand those teachings. So what is all this all pointing to? I mean, what I see is how fundamental, when we talk about ethical conduct being the basis of the path, Nagarjuna is really giving us the planks, board by board. And that's the first cause of having a precious human rebirth, which we need. So question 11 then, what qualities does a person with wisdom have?
Having accurately analyzed all actions of body, speech, and mind, always acts for the benefit of self and others.
Verse 7. Having accurately analyzed all actions of the body, speech, and mind, always acts for the benefit of self and others. So I also pulled a bit from Jonsei Chögyam Rinpoche's teachings on this text. He taught from the same commentary that Khinzer Tekchok did. And Rinpoche said, a wise person carefully scrutinizes all actions they engage in as to whether they are virtuous, non-virtuous, or neutral. They abandon non-virtuous and neutral actions and strive to engage in virtue, and they dedicate it for unexcelled highest awakening. This is done to benefit self and others, and dedicating the merit towards all sentient beings. So there's a few steps in there. A wise person is scrutinizing, analyzing, checking, redirecting if we're not on target, and then dedicating the merit. Dedicating the merit for full awakening and for all sentient beings. So it's a good outline for how to really focus our ethical conduct towards this highest good. He continues, he says, the ideal vessel for these teachings in the precious garland constantly examines their actions of body, speech, and mind. Such a person understands the best way to benefit themselves and others, and that person is called wise.
It seems like in verse 6 and verse 7, in verse 6, somebody is following ethical conduct out of faith, and someone else is, in 7, is following it out of reasoning, but they're both following the path of karma.
Oh, that's a good observation. So verse 6, they're following ethical conduct out of faith. Verse 7, they're following ethical conduct out of reasoning. And that both points you towards the path, right?
Whatever gets you on the bus.
Yeah. Yes. Online?
Online. And the person has written, a wise person always acts with four establishments of mindfulness in mind.
Four establishments of mindfulness in mind. So mindfulness on the body, mindfulness of feelings, mindfulness of mind, mindfulness of phenomena. I can't see any reason why that wouldn't be true. Yeah. Which goes on to the next question. Oh, yeah, to add?
I mean, it seems like mentioned the benefit of self and others, so the motivation is always bodhicitta.
Ah, yes, very good point. The motivation is bodhicitta. That's part of the commentary, or is that right there in the verse? Always examining for self and others. I have to look back. Always act for the benefit of self and others, right? Right, so with a clear motivation as to why they're doing it. Can we go on? Question 12, three parts. What are the 10 non-virtuous paths of action?
You want them in order?
Sure.
Not killing?
Uh-huh.
Not stealing?
Non-virtuous paths of action.
Well, the opposite. Excuse me. Saving lives?
No.
What are
the non-virtuous ones?
Thank you.
Yeah, killing.
Oh, okay. Killing?
Yeah.
Stealing?
Stealing.
Unwise or unkind sexual conduct?
Yeah.
Lying?
Yes, lying.
Divisive speech?
Yes.
Harsh speech?
Divisive speech, harsh speech.
Idle talk?
Idle talk.
Covetousness?
Maliciousness. Malice, yes, and ill will?
And wrong views.
Wrong views, or the text says, I think it says nihilistic views. These are the 10 bright, no, oops. The 10 gloomy ones. That's not what the question asked, though. The question asked, what are the 10 non-virtuous ones? Right. We've covered them, and Venerable Tarpa gave us quite a beautiful review of those. So we don't need to linger there, I don't think. But this is, achievement of high status arises from the practice of virtue. This is Rinpoche again. The practice of virtue begins with turning away from non-virtue. So we have to understand what non-virtue is. So we need to know these. We need to know them frontwards and backwards, actually. Because this is what we are turning away from, really, at the base. Then comes the question, what are the parts that make an action complete?
Preparation, doing the action.
Okay, so preparation, doing the action, completing the action, and rejoicing. And what does preparation entail?
Intention.
Intention?
And the object.
Identifying the object. And?
Affliction.
And affliction has to be present. So what does it mean to be a complete action?
It's a complete action. Does that mean that it will be a throwing karma and result in
If it's a complete action, then all four, results, three or four, depending, results of karma, come, all the four results come from that action. So that's a complete one. So let's take that apart just a little bit. We won't take a whole lot of time with this, but yeah, of the parts, all the different parts. So what does that mean? Preparation, correctly identified. Let's take which one we haven't done. Harsh speech. Correctly identifying the object. I see person A over there doing something that I don't approve of.
I get angry. That's an affliction.
I get angry. The affliction arises. And?
I'm angry at that person, so I correctly identify that person.
I'm angry at that person. I've correctly identified that person. And I have said, I'm going to tell her off.
Yeah.
I have the intention.
Or at least you have it in your mind.
I have it in my mind. To myself, I think, I'm going to say that. It might be a very quick thought. But we don't do anything without intention, so we have that intention to do the act. Preparation. Okay, next step, what happens?
The
words fly out of your mouth.
The words fly out of their mouth, our mouth, my mouth. You blah, 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 blah. Oh yeah, maybe some gestures too. You blah, 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 blah. You blah, 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 you blah, blah, you, blah, blah, blah. And then what? Huh, wait.
They understand it.
They understand it, those words register it, they get it. And we think, yeah, got her. Right? That is a complete action. Able to, therefore, create three or four, depending on how you divide them up, different results, which is leaping ahead to another question, but it's so blatantly right here that we should just go there. So what are the results?
Fruitional results.
Fruitional result meaning? Our next rebirth. So this will propel a rebirth in some other unfortunate place.
Lower realm.
Lower realm rebirth. And?
Causally concordant.
The causally concordant result. What does that mean?
It means we'll experience the same results similar to the cause.
Yeah. Results. So somebody will be doing the same thing to us. Somewhere, somehow, sometime. The third one? We've got the, well, two.
We're doing a four.
We did the causally concordant result. Did we do that? Did I did break it up? I didn't.
That one has two.
That has two parts.
Oh. Yeah, there's the causally concordant, that's the habit.
Yeah, so the other one is then have the habit to do it again. So having so not only experiencing it again, but also reinforcing the habit to do it again. Which clearly is the most, no matter how bad your rebirth is, this one is the worst of those, right? And then the fourth one is the environmental result. So, and I don't have the chart of what's what, but harsh speech usually is like rocky environments and terrible places. Yeah, rocky places, and you know, and not having good relationships with people, and when you have a human rebirth again, and so forth and so forth and so forth. So it's useful, I find, to really look at what are my experiences, if I can get my mind off my own suffering with nasty thing coming up, but to then look at what are the causes for what I'm experiencing now. And for harsh speech, for example, am I continuing to, I'm experiencing this sort of result, okay, I'm receiving some harsh speech, I'm in a rocky place, I have a tendency to do the same kind of speech myself, am I continuing to create the causes for this? Well, yes, I'm afraid so. Working on it, but. So it's useful to look at it from both of those directions. And I think it's useful too. I mean, Venerable also, when she was teaching it, she really had us think about what are the results of these actions. And so to review that and meditate on those helps deepen our conviction. really helps deepen our and our application of our understanding, and helps to move our understanding of karma from our heads a little bit further down into our actions. Because, why? Because we want to be creating the causes for a good rebirth. Because, why? Because we want to continue to be able to practice the Dharma so that we can overcome our ignorance, so that we can really be free from all of this. Okay, now I skipped around. What does it mean for an action to be complete? We talked about that. Question 13. Can we go on? What are the three actions to abandon? Describe them.
Taking intoxicants.
Harming others.
Wrong livelihood.
Wrong livelihood. What's the other word? Yeah, wrong livelihoods. There's another word for it. I can't remember what it is. Are they self-evident, the taking of intoxicants? Like, why? We are not able to make wise decisions. Our minds are cloudy, we're clear. And not even just when we're drunk. If we're also in the habit of taking intoxicants, our minds aren't clear when we're sober, too. And if we're in the habit of taking intoxicants, how much of our life is around that craving, that lifestyle? Quite a lot. So this certainly undermines our ethical practice. What's non-harming entail?
Avoiding physically or verbally humiliating people, embarrassing them, feeling inadequate, it's having motivation to harm.
Yeah. And then the wrong livelihoods, there's a whole question on that, so we'll get to that in a minute. But what about wrong livelihoods for lay people? What's a wrong livelihood to avoid?
For example, producing things that are harming.
Making guns?
Yeah, making guns, maybe. Making producing things that harm.
Not cheating others.
Lying.
Being a butcher.
Not killing others, right? Or a bartender, not serving alcohol to others, yes. Yes. Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
Flight attendants have that problem.
So a couple of people are very concerned. Fishermen.
Yeah. Jyotsi Chidra Rinpoche said, these 13 are called the dharmas to be turned away from or to be abandoned. And by avoiding them, this alone, this too is virtue. So we have that reinforced, that what we didn't cover, we covered it last week, that just doing the opposite of the 10 non-virtuous paths of action is virtuous. Refraining from them is virtuous also. So that's all creating virtue. And then there was something I also had here from Jeffrey's thing on these six, not drinking intoxicants. His is a different translation a little bit. A good livelihood, not harming, respectful giving, honoring the honorable, and love, which are the next ones we're going to get into, the ones to practice. He calls these to be practiced two of the six epitomes of religious practice. These six together are contained. Not drinking intoxicants, having a good livelihood, not harming, respectful giving, honoring the honorable, and love. That these are what are called the six epitomes of religious practice. So it's an interesting way to frame it. It's different from the 16 that we put it together in. But I thought it was an interesting way of thinking about it, so it's good to bring it up. So that takes us to what are the three actions to practice? Do we need to repeat them? Respectful generosity, honoring the worthy, cultivating love. So generosity includes the four kinds of giving, right? Giving material possessions, giving fearlessness, so protecting those that are in danger and so forth. Giving love, support, encouragement, and then giving the Dharma, which entails teachings, sharing the Dharma, said to be the highest form of generosity. Honoring the worthy is what?
Showing respect for those who are superior to us in virtuous qualities.
Being who would that be?
To our teacher.
Being respectful to our teacher.
It can also be those who have more knowledge.
Those with more, yeah.
Holy beings.
Holy beings, yeah. Honoring those worthy of respect. And love? What all is included in that? Equanimity, compassion, sympathetic joy. Now, of these six, well, let's just go with these three. Which of these are easier for you and which are more challenging?
Sometimes the equanimity aspect of love is very difficult.
So the equanimity aspect of love is difficult, and which ones are easier to practice for you?
Honoring the worthy.
Honoring the worthy, those worthy of honoring, is easy? Is that true for everybody?
I think everybody is their own individual, unique person, and have their own individual, unique yeses and noes.
Yeah. Well, I'm asking if that's universal, because when Venerable taught it, she pointed out that that was the one that we have the most difficulty with as Westerners. But I think you've got a training that actually might set you up for having a mind able to do that more readily. Yeah. Yeah.
I think that might be the easiest for me too, actually.
Honoring those worthy of honor.
Yeah, because respect. Feel it comes up.
Uh-huh.
When there's afflictions running in the mind, though, all of these are difficult.
I think so, too. When there are afflictions running in the mind, they're all difficult.
And then I don't think we always know who's worthy of honoring. I mean,
as in recognizing?
A yellow hat, you know, our teacher's recognizable, but there may be other people that we don't, we're blind to their good qualities.
Yeah, so not able to see good qualities because we don't see so well. Unless the person's wearing the right clothes. Yeah. Did anybody think, I didn't, I'm just asking, if anybody intentionally, when we had this, kind of pointed up these three to practice for a while, did that come to anybody's mind? And what was your experience if it was? Anybody out there?
I don't know, I just thought about it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I was trying to think about this one about, because the comments about honoring the worthy, mostly I think I just tried to examine my mind and see if, is that true for me? Like, where is the problem and where am I doing okay? So I think that's the thing I did the strongest after.
Reflect on these and see which, or just think about them.
Yeah.
No, that's good.
I will say what I did is I would just kind of go through the list and make sure I had it memorized. And, you know, of course, I'd probably forget it and then do it again and look it up.
Yeah.
I still probably have to do that. But just to try to make it like, oh, this is what you need to do, and just kind of get it at that level.
Yeah.
You know, just to have it in my awareness. It's like, wow, if you want to really get along here, you don't just think of the 10, because I'm more versed in the 10.
Yeah.
And so I try to just think about them more and think about why they
Yeah, wonderful. So Venerable Karpa, I don't know if people are hearing her, but spending a lot of time thinking about them, because we are pretty well versed in the 10, if we've been studying for any period of time. But these additional six, three to abandon and three to adopt, are something to really, that are worth thinking about. And you know, I think sometimes it's very, with so many practices and what do we do and how do I think about and what deity should I do and what's Lam Rim should I do, and you know, what Venerable has presenting us with, and that Kensar Tekchak is presenting us with, that Nagarjuna is presenting us with, is a very straightforward think about these things. Do these things. It's only 16. And it's not, and although the question here was about what are the destructive or the negative pathways of action, the text, I believe, is talking about do the gleaming actions, which are those opposites. So if we, you know, really cultivate practicing those 10 virtuous actions, really practice abandoning those three that we are to be abandoned, and then practice again cultivating the other three, love, non-harming, and wishing to, you know, honoring worthy, those worthy of honor, respecting those worthy of respect. That's a lot. And that lays the groundwork, the foundation for achieving this good rebirth that we're looking for. Somebody online? Yeah.
One person says, I thought about the benefits to my mind of honoring the worthy and the effect on others of respectful generosity. That's one person. And the second person is your, I think the qualification of respectful generosity is quite powerful, not just giving without some consideration, not just giving without some consideration of the impact of giving, not a blanket assumption that any giving is good.
Mm-hmm. So thinking about giving thoughtfully. Yeah. And also checking the motivation. Most importantly, perhaps. Yeah, very good observations, all of them.
I saw a study online on the superior's life when we learn to, you know, I think we Westerners probably learn to respect those superior to us, like our spiritual mentor. And this is, I learned that this is a great chance actually to extend your ability to honor others, if, because like our teacher is a great example, and it's easier for us to learn to honor, to respect, and so we get that in our habit, because like for example, if you live with your teacher, if you're lucky, then you have it constantly. Then you're facing others, and it gets much more easy. You kind of, you copy it over.
Yeah.
And you have to do it with others, because you never know who's in front of you. Look like them, but they might be somebody totally else of a lot of hormone.
Yeah. So again, I don't know if people can hear what people are saying or not, but to repeat, it's really worth repeating, that when we practice honoring the worthy, in terms of our teachers, for example, especially if we're around our teacher a lot, you need to be training all the time. And that honor, that habit that you begin to develop, you also begin to extend to other people around you. So, yeah.
I think it just kind of dawns on your mind, like, why am I not doing this for others?
Everybody else.
You're learning a new skill.
Yeah.
You know, honoring the worthy.
Yeah.
What it makes you aware of your lack of respect
for your teacher and everybody else.
And then you just learn how to, you know, recognize it more and work with it.
Yeah, so you learn to respect others.
Yeah. It's important.
Yeah, it's very important. Very important. Let's do, even though we're a little bit over, let's do this last one on the five wrong livelihoods kind of quickly. We had a little slow running start, just because that's where we needed to get. So this question, what are the five wrong livelihoods for monastics, is really about how monastics procure the four requisites. So what are these five? Hypocrisy. Second one? Flattery. Hinting.
Giving a small gift to get a large gift.
Giving a small gift to get a large gift.
Pretentious.
pretentious and showing off. Yeah. This was a different wording for this one. Yeah, trying to get something that's by appearing different from what you are. Jigetsu Rinpoche, Jungse Chujin Rinpoche he says, by wanting some wealth or gain, so that's, we have to want this wealth or gain, something. We have the idea, how nice if this person would give it to me. Or how nice if this person would serve me. So we have a motivation to get something. We identify an object, we want that person to do it, and then we have the thought, I'll induce them to do that. So whether it's conscious or not, you know, we can have many little unconscious motivations going sometimes. So it's one something to be really watchful of. And then Venerable asked, do you ever go in the direction of procuring requisites through these?
I mean, luckily, it doesn't come out of the mouth, but you're just kind of like, you know, you're kind of like, well, how do I deal with this? You know, yeah. Oh, you're a good hand, because it's just, I think it's true that we really were raised with that.
Yeah, so the thought comes up, whether you even actually, and so watching it is fantastic. And it's true that we were raised with this kind of, well, you wouldn't flat out ask your aunt for a new sweater, but you could hint for it. And then here we are in a position again where we're not buying our own. How do you get it? So just saying it's a nice warm sweater, but someone could certainly take it as a hint.
Yeah. Right, and so you learn not to make those comments.
Yeah, you have to learn to be very careful with it.
You really learn quickly not to make those kind of comments.
Because people are very kind.
It comes flying in the door.
Yeah, people are very kind. And you may or may not have meant to hint, but either way, we have to be careful about that. So I think this is a good one to think about. It's so easy. It's, you know, when I first heard these teachings on the five wrong livelihoods, I was a layperson, and I thought, like, big deal. What is this? You know, you want something, you go buy it. Well, now I know different. So they're really worth thinking about a lot.
Could you name the fifth one in proper words?
This one said, misusing your property to get more. So that's the small gift giving a small gift and then expecting them to give you another one. Or, this is even trickier, saying, you know, commenting like, do you like my cup? His Holiness the Dalai Lama gave this cup. I'm worthy of gifts from high, big people. And then the pretentious one actually is pretty, we didn't really talk about that one, but that is, it's not just the hypocrisy of, I think I'm a great practitioner, and I mean, I'm not a great practitioner, but when the benefactors are around, I'm squeaky clean and good. It's more like kind of hinting, like, I have high realizations. I'm somebody like that. So, in the end, so Venerable said, you can see that when we're talking about obtaining a precious human life, these 16 are so important. So by practicing the first 10, just a quick review, we keep good ethical conduct, and that's the basic cause of upper rebirth. By abandoning intoxicants, we create the cause to have a clear mind and good intelligence. By abandoning wrong livelihoods, we create the cause to have the possessions we need to do our practice. By being generous, we'll have the material wherewithal to practice and to create merit. By honoring the worthy, people will be attracted to us. We'll have Dharma friends and we'll have good relationships with our teachers. We'll have good relationships with other sentient beings. And by cultivating the four immeasurables, we'll have good relationships with other peaceful and a peaceful mind. So she said it's good to do a life review and see how we do with these 16. Do we practice what's to be practiced? Do we abandon what's to be abandoned? And then we can see and work out what needs to be taken care of. Okay? Okay. Thank you. This is juicy practice stuff. It's really good. Really good practice. So let's dedicate. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious body, mind not yet born, arise and grow. May the born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezi, may you stay until samsara ends. May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it, have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Lobsang's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase. Fearless Supreme Spiritual Leader, Omniscient King of the Shakyas, Malili Tara, Supreme Bestower of Longevity and Wisdom, Vast Ocean Assembly of Sources of Refuge, grant propitiousness here and now for a nectar of benefit and bliss to flow. With a clear mind of extensive learning gained from following the wondrous traditions of Tupten, the Able One's teachings, you bring clarity to masses of disciples with the light of children, the lamp of the Dharma. May your lotus feet remain unfaltering for a very long time. Through your dharmic deeds of hearing, thinking, meditating, and so on, place those who seek the liberated path in harmony through immaculate discipline. Please lead all beings to liberation, undeclining excellent qualities of scripture and insight, and establish them in a glory of eternal bliss. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma, done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Shravasti Abbey in the West, flourish.